Hello and welcome to the CISS podcast. This is the Point series by China Forum. In this series, we will have one-on-one discussions with top-level officials, diplomats, well-known entrepreneurs, academics, and media experts from both China and abroad to hear their fresh insights on important global issues.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the Point series. This is Beibei from China Forum, Tsinghua University. Today, we have five guests for our panel discussion on the future of China-U.S. relations, with a specific focus on the impact of Trump's re-election on this bilateral relationship. We are honored to have with us Professor Da Wei, Director of CISS and Professor in the Department of International Relations at Tsinghua University, who will speak with a focus on foreign policy, and Ms. Xiao Qian, Deputy Director of CISS at Tsinghua University, who will speak with a focus on people-to-people exchange, and Mr. Zhou Bo, retired Senior Colonel with a background in military services, who is a Senior Fellow at CISS and a China Forum expert. Mr. Zhou will provide his opinions with an emphasis on the military perspective, and Professor Gong Jun, who teaches economics at the University of International Business and Economics, will speak with a focus on economics and international trade. And also Professor Xie Tao, Dean of the School on International Relations and Diplomacy at Beijing Foreign Studies University. He will share with us his expertise from the political perspective, especially regarding U.S. domestic politics. And now a very warm welcome to all of our experts. Thank you, everyone, for joining our interview today. And our warm-up question is regarding the 2024 U.S. election. So following the U.S. presidential election, what new shifts have you noticed in U.S. social and political climate? And what are your feelings and thoughts about the re-election of Donald Trump? And we would like to start with Professor Da Wei, with a special emphasis on foreign policy. Please, Professor Da.
Yeah, thank you, Beibei. I think this election is a very important election because this election gave President Trump the second term. And we know that President Trump has been a very controversial political figure all over the world and also including the United States. But in this election, he got a victory, which is really clear. I mean, not only he won the electoral votes, he also won the popular votes. He won all the seven swing states. And the Republican Party won in both chambers of the Congress. So those outcomes show a very clear signal that the majority American people, maybe it's slightly, you know, more than half of American voters, I mean the elected voters, choose the path or the policy or the slogan, the narrative that President Trump advocates for. I mean, though it's controversial, though many people in the U.S. and outside the U.S. may have different understanding, different idea about these political ideas, it gained the support from the American people. So we need to think about what this signal is about. For me, this is more or less a signal focused on nationalism and populism. I think U.S. is withdrawing from the economic globalization and also is withdrawing from a Western country-led liberal international order. And we are moving into a nationalist global international order. This is something really, really big because all of us, you know, since the end of the Cold War, we lived in the globalization time, and in the Western country, they call it a liberal international order or rules-based order. In China, we call it a post-Cold War order. I think this order and the globalization has put it in a very simple and maybe provocative way, ended. And this will give the U.S., give other countries, including China, a very different environment. So that's my reading from this election.
Professor Da, could you help us clarify what you mean by nationalist international order?
Yeah, I mean, after the end of the Cold War, the U.S. and Western country pursued a kind of, I call it universalism. So they try to push economic globalization, try to lower the national border, try to lower the tariffs and the non-tariff barriers. They try to also introduce the Western value to the whole world. This is so-called liberal international order. But now I think actually not only the US and many countries, but the US as the most powerful country are pursuing a policy which prioritizes their national agenda. Like we will see more tariffs in trade and a non-tariff barrier in trade. We will see more industrial policy in their economic policy. We will see the US is reluctant to get involved in conflict, you know, outside its border. So this is so-called America first, right? So you put your own country first rather than pursuing some universal, no matter its norm or value or agenda. So this is a shift. I think the US is moving to a nationalist policy, while actually you can also say that maybe more than 8 years ago, the Brexit, when the Great Britain withdrew from EU, that's also a nationalist agenda. And there are also other countries in this world are pursuing this nationalist policy agenda, putting their national interest as a top priority. When it becomes a global phenomenon, this is something quite new, I will say.
I see. So in a way, they're turning inward.
Yeah, they are turning inward. And from the country, they play the leadership role, they turn inward and they try to protect their narrowly defined national interest and are less interested in providing public goods, no matter economic public goods or public goods in security area.
Thank you, Professor Dawei. And next, we have Professor Xie Tao, please.
Thank you for having me here. So let me start off by borrowing from the Communist Manifesto. So there is this specter haunting Europe. In this case, of course, it's the United States of America. And the specter of Donald Trump. So Republican reestablishment and Democrats have formed alliance to exorcise this specter, but to no avail. So what I want to say is that the return of Donald Trump is a big surprise to most people. Now, let's say if his victory back 8 years ago in 2016 was a surprise, and this 2024 victory was a shock to many people, people like me, because I thought, given Donald Trump's track record during his 4 years, for example, his trade policy, his immigration policy, and many others, I think most American people thought they were down with Donald Trump. They were having none of anything to do with him. It turned out we misjudged the prevailing sentiment in America. Populism, or nationalist populism, as many people describe it, is still in full swing in the United States. And I do not see any kind of a sign that this will subside in any near future. And so we'd better be prepared for 4 more years of populism on steroids under Donald Trump.
4 more years of populism on steroids. That's an interesting observation. And are your thoughts on this, Mr. Zhou Bo?
Well, you see, when Joe Biden was elected, most people consider the first term of Donald Trump was a kind of aberration of history. But now he's re-elected, so people seem to argue that maybe Joe Biden's term is an aberration of history. So we don't know. The fact is that he has made a lot of waves around the world recently by talking about taking back Panama militarily, by talking about taking back Greenland. All this, of course, have raised a protest from Denmark. So I believe another 4 years would not stabilize the world. Actually, the world would be more divided. The question is whether he could unite the United States domestically. I don't think so. Economic speaking, maybe he could perform well, because even Joe Biden was doing well. But then the most interesting thing is about his policy towards China, because apparently he has reached out with the olive branch to China by first inviting Chinese President Xi Jinping to attend his inauguration. And then he even talked about China's role in the war in the Russo-Ukrainian conflict. He talked about how he wished China might help. Of course, this is a billion-dollar question, how China might help. But I do believe that China can play a positive role in that, because he talked about how he could resolve this issue in 24 hours. And when he talked about China's possible help, that means he could not resolve this issue in 24 hours, right? He needs help from outside. So what could China's role be? I think China might be most useful in what everybody was talking about, the so-called collective security guarantee, when finally we come to a ceasefire, because no war will last forever. Right now, nobody knows how long the war will last, but no war will last forever. And the first thing that might come is definitely, the ceasefire. But for Ukraine, the worry is that it is facing with a superpower. So therefore, it has no self-confidence. Therefore, it needs collective security guarantee. And in this, I think China's role is indispensable.
So you see more division, both domestically and globally, with Trump's second administration. Thank you for your input from the military perspective. And next, I would like to ask Professor Gong Zhong, what are your thoughts on this question?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me. I think the return of Donald Trump represents the climax of a long-going conservative movement in the United States. This has been going on for some time, and finally they're now in control of the White House, as well as the Congress, as well as the Supreme Court. You know, American politics has always been sort of swinging back and forth between the right and left, and this time it's clearly swinging to the right. And I'm actually less optimistic in terms of, you know, the number of years Donald Trump is, or at least the conservative movement or the right, the Republican Party, is going to control Washington. I think it's probably going to be more than 4 years, 8 years, even 12 years. Now, the problem is that this is way more than just a conservative movement. It's also adulterated with a dose of authoritarianism and even imperialism, in my view, that has been advanced so far by Donald Trump. So as a matter of fact, this has international implications. You know, the talk about, quote, purchase of Greenland or the recontrol of the Panama Canal, all of these things have huge international and global implications. I think this very worrisome development even has the risk of maybe even approaching the very core fabrics of American democracy, American institutions, with the way that Trump is going. You know, as I said, he's controlling the two houses. The Republican Party is controlling the Supreme Court. So he has a lot of leeway and freedom to do a lot of things he wants. And we all understand that some of the thoughts and innate desires of Donald Trump are quite dangerous, to be honest.
So even before he's officially taking office, we can already see his policies shaking, not just domestically, but globally. And now we turn to Ms. Xiaoqian, please.
Okay, thank you. Just after the election and after Donald Trump was re-elected, as far as I see, from the point of the people-to-people exchanges, we have received more U.S. delegations coming to China just within this month. Of course, they came and then they want to have more exchanges of views with the Chinese experts, and also many young students are coming to have exchanges with Chinese students, which is very encouraging to us. So we see there's a strong feeling that those young people wanted to go to China to know more about China and to have exchanges and discussions with the young Chinese people. On the other hand, we also can feel a kind of worry or concern that after Trump comes into office, there might be some disturbances in terms of the people-to-people exchanges, because we all know that in the first Donald Trump's administration, he issued a few policies and took actions which were not good to people-to-people exchanges. For example, in December 2017, he released the National Security Strategy during his first year in office, and he labeled China as a strategic competitor and a rival that challenged the Americans' power, influence, and interests. This was really not good to China-U.S. relations. And later on, he also repeatedly regarded China as a revisionist power or strategic competitor to U.S. So there is a fear or concern that if he comes into office, he might have some other actions which is not good to people-to-people exchanges. That is something I observed recently within just 1 month. Yes.
It's good to hear that there are already more U.S. delegations coming into China. And in fact, an interesting observation, I saw this chorus from the U.S. I think it's named One Voice, and they have been performing across China at least the past few days. And they're very young students. And I even saw this video of them singing a beautiful Chinese song in Chinese in the Temple of Heaven. And we certainly wish to see more of this happening in the future. Now, we move on to our first core question, which is regarding Trump administration 2.0. So in recent weeks, Trump has already announced many cabinet and staff appointments for his second administration. And what can we read from Trump's picks so far? And what changes do you think these appointments signal regarding U.S. domestic and foreign policy, especially policies towards China? And can we hear from Professor Dawei, please?
I think President-elect Trump picked some very interesting cabinet member for his second term. I will say, particularly on the national security side, he picked several senior staffs or cabinet member very hawkish to China. Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, both of them are quite hawkish to China, so some people call them super hawk. But at the same time, he also picked some cabinet members more pragmatic to China. For instance, the Secretary of Treasury, Bencent, Secretary of Commerce, Lutnick. So they may also advocate for some policy that China does not like high tariff, but I don't think they are aiming at China particularly. I think these are the readjustment of the U.S. economic relationship with the whole world. So this is a very diversified and also divided. Then this team also, all the members, I think, are very loyal to President Trump, and they had good image on media, on TV. So those are the characteristics. So the most important thing is, since they have different views towards China and they are loyal to President Trump, so will the more hawkish view or the more pragmatic view prevail in Trump's team? This question was decided by President Trump himself. So President Trump will set the tone of the future U.S. policy to China, and then his cabinet member and the senior staff will follow his tone. So I think the pick of the staffs and the cabinet member tell us a reality that President Trump is the most important figure who will decide the future policy to China, and his team may have some internal fight in the future. So I do hope that the diplomacy between the senior leaders of China and the United States can bring or can at least lay the foundation for more stable bilateral relations in the next 4 years.
I see. So we will wait and see how the hawkish and the pragmatic elements play out in the future. Thank you, Professor Dawei. And next, let's welcome Professor Xie Tao. What's your opinion on this?
Obviously, it's a fascinating question. It's a million-dollar question that has been the focus of a lot of Chinese analysts and pundits. So, for example, Donald Trump has done this unprecedented diplomatic move by inviting informally or reportedly our President Xi Jinping to attend his inauguration ceremony. And he also has done something very extraordinary. For example, as mentioned by one of the other speakers, that he wanted to purchase Greenland. He wanted to take back the Panama Canal, right? And so for Donald Trump, you know, no matter it's China policy or U.S. foreign policy in general, it's predicting the unpredictable. It's pretty tough. There's this famous saying from a very famous U.S. baseball player, Yogi Berra. You know, it's tough to make predictions, especially about the future. And so you can apply the same quote to Donald Trump, you know, who is notoriously unpredictable. So it's tough to predict the future, and especially about the notoriously unpredictable upcoming commander-in-chief of the United States. But with that said, I think, you know, look at all Chinese analysts and pundits' commentary on Donald Trump 2.0. I think the key area where a lot of people is really concerned is about his trade policy in particular, and his broad economic and technological policy towards China. We know that the United States is vitally important to the health of the Chinese economy. United States market is one of the largest for Chinese exports. And so how Donald Trump will use whatever policy tools that he has to deal with China, this will be one of the biggest uncertainties, of course, for the next couple of weeks. And people are paying a lot of attention to this.
Predicting the unpredictable seems to be getting even harder. And speaking of uncertainties, that's actually our next core question. So regarding the uncertainties and risks of Trump's China Policy 2.0, considering the political environment and characteristics of Trump's second term, how would you evaluate future China-US relations, the uncertainties, risks, challenges, and maybe opportunities involved? And to be more specific, for example, in terms of potential tariffs, increasing technology sanctions, possible negotiations, and potential new channels of communication. And we would like to start the answer with Mr. Zhou Bo, please.
Well, certainly we do not know why he would pick all those people as his new tenants. But I believe that his appointment is not entirely because of China, because a lot of these people don't seem to be friendly toward China given their personal records, such as the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, who actually is under China sanction. But then we cannot explain why Donald Trump actually is extending an olive branch towards China, because after all, he's the commander-in-chief. So we will have to wait and see how all these might unfold. Talking about uncertainty in China-US relationship, I believe the best Chinese strategy is kind of certainty on Chinese side, because we have to become the stabilizer in this regard. Trump liked to talk about how he's unpredictable, that he's not even shy to talk about it as a kind of his secret weapon. But I believe that all the world needs a kind of openness and predictability. So therefore, in this kind of relationship, on one side is a man who brag about himself being unpredictable. Therefore, on the other side, that is Chinese side, we need to give confidence to the world to show that we can become the stabilizer. And could China become a stabilizer? I think so, because I believe China, after some economic turn down, now is moving in the right direction. And China's military is still having a budget that is lower than 2%, which is NATO standard. And this lower than 2% defense expenditure actually tells a lot about China, about China's confidence, about the region, or even about the China-US relationship.
Thank you, Mr. Zhou Bo. And now next we turn to Professor Gong Jun. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, first of all, I think Donald Trump's political agenda is first and foremost about domestic politics. And in terms of its international agenda, I don't think China even comes to the top of its agenda. I think in general, Donald Trump is of the belief that the United States should be less reliant upon the trade between China and the United States. But how to achieve that goal, whether he is going to do this sort of in a very disruptive manner, in a sense of imposing, you know, extra high tariffs, as he was talking about it during the campaign trail, something like 60%, that I'm not sure. I think given the current situation internationally, given even his international agendas, with respect to Ukraine, for example, with respect to other priorities he has just started to talk about, like Greenland and Panama. Against that backdrop, I think he might be less inclined to do something drastic. That's actually, you know, I think it's probably good news for China. It's probably good news from Beijing's perspective. For example, he definitely needs to address the Ukraine issue. And on that, he has openly said, actually put out a tweet post himself, saying that, essentially indicating that he needs China's help. On other issues, he probably also needs China's cooperation, not in terms of support, but at least I think in terms of less vocal opposition from his perspective. So I think against that backdrop, also against the backdrop of the people surrounding him who are not entirely sort of, you know, 100% anti-China, some of them do have extensive business interests in China. So against all these factors I've just mentioned, I think I would anticipate that he probably will do something a little bit more moderate, not something drastic. He probably will still impose tariffs, but not to a great extent. But I still want to remind our audience that over the long run, Trump is of the firm belief that the United States and China should be trading less, not meaning that they're entirely decoupled, but at least less coupled. This is probably definitely in his vision.
So you see a more moderate and probably more independent face on the American side. What's your thought on this, Professor Xie Tao?
I just mentioned very briefly about some of these uncertainties, such as trade policy, economic policy in general. But we don't just focus on uncertainties associated with Donald Trump, the person, the individual. You know, his personality, his temperament, of course, that's totally unpredictable, as I just said. But there are also some structural factors that could also be highly unpredictable and uncertain. One example would be, who would have foreseen that the Ukrainians would have an armed conflict with the Russians in starting from 2022? And who would have foreseen that on October 7th, 2023, I remember I was in Washington, D.C., that there would have this outbreak of war between Hamas and Israel. And so in that sense, Donald Trump was doubly blessed during his first term when none of these armed conflicts had occurred. But who would foresee that none of this would not repeat something of the scale and the intensity of the Ukrainian-Russian conflicts or Israel-Hamas armed conflicts? One can easily imagine that in what happens with the DPRK, or perhaps, you know, there's some domestic turmoil in one of the United States' most important ally, the Republic of Korea. And then maybe something that, you know, unexpected that happens in Turkey, in Iran. So all these uncertainties could have some, you know, big impact on Donald Trump's foreign policy decision. So I think, you know, coming back to the full circle, when we talk about uncertainty, Donald Trump, at least appears to me that he seems to utterly enjoy being viewed as being unpredictable. And so this would give him some added leverage at the negotiation table. You know, to put this in a slightly less favorable way, I said this in an article that I just finished. So Donald Trump is kind of setting up a racketeering scheme. So every time he says he threatens to impose sanctions, and then at a price, he's going to take back the sanctions. So it's very much like an organized racketeering scheme. With all these uncertainties, like most Chinese analysts advised over the past couple of weeks, that the best for China to do is to stay strategically focused and strengthen China itself on the economic front, technological front, and you know, many other areas. And so to be strong yourself, to negotiate out the position of strength, I think that's the way out of this whole impasse between the two countries.
Maintaining the stability that Mr. Joe Bo mentioned earlier. And also, I think that's a great reminder for everybody that, you know, to step back and look beyond Donald Trump. And next, we turn to Professor Dawei, please.
Yeah, I think the answer to this uncertainty really depends on how the U.S. and China, particularly the two leaders, how they interact in the early phase of the second term. As I said, the Trump administration will have a very divided team. So the decision or the tone set by President Trump will determine the future policy from the Trump administration. So this is the uncertainty, of course. So if he decided to maintain a stable relationship with China, we may have bigger chance to stabilize it. And if he chooses a confrontational one, probably we will have a very bumpy relationship. At the same time, it also depends on how China reacts to President Trump's potential policy. For instance, people are talking about tariff. I think for me, tariff is something as a given. So this is something President Trump, I guess, will definitely do. We just don't know the level. But how will China react to this new imposed tariff? It's uncertain. We don't know. So will we see a tit-for-tat approach to this tariff, or we will see a more restrained Chinese reaction? We don't know. So for that reason, I think there are some questions need to be answered on both sides. And all this will create some uncertainty in the bilateral relations.
Well, the future is certainly uncertain. And now we would like to ask Ms. Xiaoqian, with an emphasis on maybe new possibilities in people-to-people exchanges in the future.
Thank you. As we all know that after the COVID, there was a big decrease between US and China in terms of the people-to-people exchanges. I remembered quite clearly that in 2021, that was also during the first Trump administration, there were only around 100 US students studying in Beijing. That was really a very surprising figure to us. In 2023, after President Xi Jinping's visit to US, China declared that we would like to invite 50,000 young people, US people, to China within the next 5 years. Also, Tsinghua University here, we worked very hard to invite more young people, US young people, to China. And we did receive a lot of delegations here. And during their visit, we are very happy to know that the US students say that they came to China and saw a totally different China, which they themselves didn't know very well back in the US. And after their exchanges or discussions with the Chinese students, they found that they really had a lot of in common. And it also encouraged them to come to China more often to have more discussions and dialogues with the Chinese young people. So I think the future of US-China relations really lies in these young people. Maybe in the next 5 years, we can have more and more US young people here in China. And based on these young people's dialogues and the communications, we have a better future of US-China relations.
Actually, because of the new visa policy, I've personally been seeing more videos from foreign travelers coming to China. And it's great to see how magic happens, you know, when they come here and meet people, talk to people face to face, and how happy and safe they feel here in China.
Exactly.
And turning our gaze into the future, based on your observations, how can China and the U.S. proactively address the upcoming challenges in China-U.S. relations? For example, in terms of economics, politics, trade, and diplomatic hurdles, and facing the re-election of Trump, which to many symbolizes the strong momentum of anti-globalization in the U.S., how do you envision the next phase of China-U.S. relations? Now we turn to Professor Xie Tao. What's your thoughts on this?
It's going to be hard to have any sort of upbeat feelings about the next 4 years of U.S.-China relations, given all these structural factors that are unfavorable towards the relationship, isn't it? But even with that said, I think there are at least a few bright spots where we could have some cautious optimism. So one area I would say is climate change. Take the still ongoing wildfire that is raging in the LA area. Of course, you know, there's a lot to blame for the dry weather, the natural conditions in that area. But also, I think, you know, part of this could be attributed to this rising temperature in not just the United States, in California, but across the world. And so, you know, there is something that the two countries desperately need to work on this with each other, and they do have some common interest. Another area, I think, is about the economic development. One of the key drives of nationalist populism in the United States is that the people who voted for Donald Trump believe that they have been the victims of globalization, that they're being unfairly, quote, treated by Chinese companies. So I think, you know, we can work on a number of ways and so that we can provide some of these economic growth projects in America by allowing, for example, Chinese investment into America. And also we welcome more American companies coming into China, and that could create more economic growth for the very electoral group that lies at the core of Donald Trump's electoral base. There could be many other areas of cooperation, such as in science and technology, like the two governments just narrowly resumed their science and technology cooperation agreement, right? And so I think, you know, we don't to be totally in the pessimistic world. We can still be cautiously optimistic looking forward at the next 4 years.
Thank you. And I hope the fire in LA, my work to change Donald Trump's opinion regarding climate change. Next, Mr. Zhou Bo, what's your thoughts on the vision of the next phase of China-U.S. relations?
Well, you see, speculations are just speculations, and all what we can say are just speculations because he has yet to take office. But I'm really concerned with what he talked about asking Taiwan to pay for protection. Yeah, this is something he said. And I was wondering how that might look like. If one asked for payment of protection, of course, Taiwanese would not pay a blank check. right? And so that most probably would be buy more arms and weapons from the United States. If that is the case, then would these kind of arms, qualitatively speaking or quantitatively speaking, be the same as was done by Donald Trump's predecessors? But I'm sure about one thing, and then China would not tolerate that. And we would definitely become more resolute in our response. Because what you have seen after Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan is that there's no longer the so-called medium line across the Taiwan Strait. Nowadays, Chinese fighter planes fly over to the other side on a regular basis. So people talk about a status quo, but a status quo are not something static. They are changeable. And any provocation coming from Taiwan or the United States regarding Taiwan issue would change the status quo. But the Chinese side then would probably become more forcefully determined in making checks. And these would, again, create a new status quo that would become irreversible and not in favor of either Taipei or Washington.
Thank you for your perspective from the Taiwan issue. And Professor Gongjun, what's your thoughts on this?
Well, I might have a slightly different perspective, but let me first concede that I'm not a defense analyst. I know very little about the military. So, just take a quick grain of thought. Well, it's very clear that Donald Trump has no interest in defending Taiwan. I mean, he openly has said this. But he is interested in making a lot of money out of the Taiwan issue. When he talks about protection money, I think he's practically talking about selling arms to Taiwan and ask Taiwan to pay, and pay a lot of money. I think probably an exorbitant amount of money. That's actually, in my view, not necessarily 100% a bad thing, at least from mainland's perspective. On one hand, I think, even from a unification's perspective, a lot of Taiwanese budget money going to the defense industry for buying things that may not have much of an impact on defense capability in cases of war opening up, breaking out, is not necessarily a bad thing, in my view, right? If you really think about it. The second issue is that the kind of weapons sold by Washington to Taiwan, is that going to make a big change in terms of its defense capability? Maybe, marginally, maybe. But I don't think it's going to make a huge impact, given the interest of Donald Trump of not really materially damaging the U.S.-China relationship. He wants money. He has the capability essentially to extort that money without materially impairing the China-U.S. relationship. I think, when it comes to arms purchase, the Taiwanese administration has absolutely no say about what things they can buy and on what terms. They just pay. So that's a little bit of a different perspective, I guess.
And can you also share with us your thoughts regarding the next phase of China-U.S. relationship from the perspective of economics and international trade?
Yeah, as I said, I think, the trade is going to be faced with ever challenging environment. The tariffs were most likely going to be introduced, even though it's not going to be, very high tariffs. But I think a lot of American companies operating in China, as well as Chinese companies currently catering to the U.S. market, they're all preparing for some kind of a plan B, I guess. This $500 billion trade, in my view, is not going to be sustainable politically, economically over the long run. It will have to be decreasing over the long run, and hopefully gradually, not drastically. Just giving some time for corporate America, corporate China to adjust to this new political reality. And that's very unfortunate, though, but it's something that I think we have to face, and we don't have a choice here. Now, China, of course, is always opening arms to American investment, foreign direct investment. And from an economic perspective, I think it's actually a good thing for some of the American companies to continue to invest in China, not just for, tapping into the huge market, but also in terms of actually catching up the technological wave. I'll just give you an example, the auto industry, for example. I think it's a great thing for Tesla and for Ford Motor Company, for GM to continue their operation in China to compete in the Chinese market so that they can also catch up with the technological wave. North America, in my view, is gradually turning into what I call an ICE island, ICE meaning internal combustion engine island. Donald Trump has a very bad view about electric cars. He called it the electric car lunacy, right? He doesn't believe in that. So I think the U.S. domestic policies with respect to the auto industry is going to be, you know, be curtailed back from the Biden administration's policy of moving towards the new energy cars, alternative energy cars. And in that regard, I think Tesla, Ford Motor Company, GM continuing to operate China would be a good thing, even from America's interest. And I hope, you know, American corporate executives can realize that. It's not just about tapping the Chinese market, making money here. It's about even maintaining corporate America's global competitiveness. I think within 10 to 20 years, a truly globally competitive company will be very difficult without the presence in the Chinese market. So from that regard, I think it's actually in both China's and America's interest to have corporate America continue to be investing in China.
So this time around, catching up means U.S. companies or other companies from North America catching up with the latest technology in China.
Absolutely. I'm not shy about saying this, particularly in the auto industry.
Right. And next we turn to Professor Dawei.
I think we will know the answer to this uncertainty very soon. I guess after the first 6 months, we will know the basic picture of next 4 years. So will that be another round of free fall, or will there be a continuity of stable bilateral relations? To stabilize the bilateral relations, I think several things are quite important. First and foremost, I think we need to understand that there is a basic structural change or the change of international order there. So it's not the Trump administration's policy or the US side's policy or Chinese side's policy. There is a tendency that the whole world is moving towards a nationalist order. So we will see some readjustment of at least the international economic relations, but moreover, the relationship among the major powers all will be changed. So no matter you like it or not, I think probably we have to bid a farewell to nostalgia and the frustration and anger, because this is something new. I mean, this order, this, you know, nationalist order is something new. We felt kind of nostalgic, or sometimes we feel angry or frustrated. I think now we should put these sentiments aside. This is something, again, no matter you like it or not, you have to accept this is the reality. With this calm down, you know, sentiments, probably we can make a wise policy option. Then we need to find out the areas that we could cooperate. There are several things we can cooperate, I think. For instance, fentanyl issue and illegal immigration issue. These are the top priority of Trump administration, which need China's help. And we can also have more effective communication over Taiwan question, though it cannot be solved, but I think strategic communication is critical. And we may also need a kind of negotiation over tariff and trade issues. How should we deal with the tariff? How can we stabilize the bilateral economic relations? And can the U.S. open the U.S. market for Chinese investment? I think these are the areas that we have potential to cooperate. So we need to grasp the opportunity. Of course, Ukraine and other hotspot issue in different regions in the world, maybe the two sides can work together. So can we grasp the opportunity? This is also a critical point to stabilize the bilateral relation.
So it sounds like it's important to put the emotions aside, to get used to a new normal, and to dive into solving problems together instead.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Yeah.
How do you envision the next phase of China-US relations? Mm-hmm. And please, Ms. Xiaotian.
Thank you. I think now the biggest challenge for U.S.-China relations is the lack of trust. During the last two administrations, we saw that China being labeled as the strategic competitor and the existential threat to U.S., which is really not good to U.S.-China relations. So in the future of U.S.-China relations, we need to rebuild trust between the two countries. And I really believe more people-to-people exchanges will help rebuild trust between the countries. So in the future, I hope we can have more young people come into China. It is really encouraging to see that U.S. State Department has changed the travel advisory level to China from level 3 to level 2, which is really encouraging because when we receive the delegations to China, the advisory warning is really a big thing for them. So this is one of the positive developments. And China has also issued more visas to the U.S. people, and we have received more delegations here in Beijing recently. So to encourage people-to-people exchange will be very good to U.S.-China relations. And I really hope that based on more and more exchanges, we will have more young people getting to know each other, which will be definitely good to our future. And another thing is that we also hope that in the future, U.S. can issue more visas to Chinese students as well, because we know that now some very brilliant young Chinese students have been refused visas when they try to study or visit U.S. So that is really also not good to the future of the U.S.-China relations, because they are really very smart young people and they want to go to U.S. to have more experience, to know more people, to know more about U.S. So I hope in the future we can have more visa granted to Chinese students as well. And all these policies should be good to encourage U.S.-China people-to-people exchanges.
Thank you. And I think whether China is a threat or an enemy or a friendly place to visit or to live, I think the people from the U.S. and from other countries, they have the wisdom to judge for themselves once they come to visit. And another interesting observation I made today on this Chinese app called Red Note. In China, it's called Xiaohongshu. Now, a flood of TikTok refugees have been coming in because they are preparing for the banning of TikTok and they want to establish their bases in another popular Chinese app. I've seen so many online bloggers posting their introduction videos on Red Note, Xiaohongshu. I think that's an interesting development, and maybe we'll see flourishing people-to-people exchanges on Chinese apps online too. Thank you, everybody. And I want to thank every one of our experts for your enlightening input and for offering a more comprehensive understanding of the impact of Trump's re-election and for providing a vision for the future of China-U.S. relations. Thank you again for taking the time to join our interview, and I hope to speak with you soon in future episodes. Thank you.